This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Lois Gannon. Lois is a Senior Vice President at AOC Key Solutions. And Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge. And Lois and Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's always interesting. Today we're going to talk about proposal preparation a fair amount, you know, what it takes to prepare a good proposal, what are the challenges in today's marketplace that both Lois and Jason are seeing with RFPs, and we'll also give Jason an opportunity to talk about the mechanics of, you know, what people hate to hear about, but are a necessary evil there, Jason?
Absolutely.
Right. That deals with bid protests and, you know, the mechanics of that, what happens with regard to a protest on the terms of an RFP and just protests in general. And Jason will walk through some of that with us today. But first, Lois, let's just talk about procurement in general and in terms of proposal preparation. And, you know, from your perspective, what are you seeing? What are the challenges? What makes, you know, the procurements these days difficult from a bidder's perspective?
Well, there are a number of things, and some of them have been from the beginning, and some are more current. One of them is vague requirements, and that makes it difficult to respond to. For example, if the government says that you need to re-interface with such and such government system, often they don't define those interfaces, so the respondent needs to try to identify what actually is required to do that, and it's very difficult. And it injects risk into the response, risk of noncompliance, and risk of either over-engineering a solution or under-engineering it and missing the mark. So that's right. One of the issues.
Yeah, well, and with regard to that issue, that's the vague requirements. That's almost like, Jason, let's put a legal hat on. That's like, you know, you've got to have requirements have to be specific enough to have an intelligent competition.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Is that sort of a legal standard?
That is the goal, of course.
Right.
Yes.
But at the same time, they can't be too specific because Lois, right? One of the issues is, you know, if you get too specific, what's that all about? Restricting competition or?
Right. I think if it's too specific, a potential offeror looking at the RFP will view it as being, quote, wired. In other words, they'll think that it's really targeted toward a specific vendor or a specific, possibly the incumbent. It could be anything from key personnel requirements, you know, so-and-so, you know, needs to have 27 years of experience. Well, clearly that's from someone's resume. That's probably the incumbent.
No, you don't say.
Which could be a mistake, but
that's when you go talk to Jason, right?
Right, exactly. So,
well, Lois, you know, what are, from your perspective, when you see, let's just talk specs, like you mentioned, vague requirements, but also the flip side is, you know, or the double, and it's not a double-edged sword, but the other, the flip side is too specific a requirement. Is the key there communication with government with regard to the question and answer period of RFPs or drafts to try to, you know, sort of educate the customer about their requirement in a certain sense?
I think the opportunity there is in the draft phase, and a lot of missed opportunities are really in the pre-solicitation phase where there just isn't enough communication between the government and the offerors. And I don't know why, but there seems to be a greater wall that's been erected between the two, which is a service to both parties at this point.
Right. So you think, you know, despite the Mythbusters campaign that OFPP launched you know, now, geez, been 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
you know,
it's been a
Dan
while.
Gordon,
mm-hmm.
That really Engaged. It's the challenges of, with regard to government communication just remain significant. Hasn't had that big an impact from your perspective?
Yes. I mean, I think that both the industry isn't initiating enough contact early enough so that they can, it's not just shaping a procurement, it's really understanding the government's requirements and helping them to clarify it for themselves so that they can issue a solicitation that they will get some competition in terms of responses and responses that truly meet their requirements.
Right. So, and from that perspective, is the flip side the one reason that, I'm trying to understand, industry is not sort of engaging as much? Is that because there's still a sense that COs and acquisition folks aren't, returning that engagement from the government side?
I think there are multiple reasons. I think that there are scarce resources on both sides. And so, and they're often very scattered, mm-hmm. so that when you're trying to, from a contractor's perspective, target multiple markets in all agencies, you're just not going after a specific procurement.
Sure, sure. So, and Jason, with regard to, that communication issue, do you see, like, people seeing it as a legal risk still?
I think people still have a fear of having a procurement integrity problem, even when there wouldn't be.
Right.
But they're in this heightened era, this era of heightened scrutiny and oversight, I think folks like to folks are very conservative and try to play it safe and stay as even, not go up to the line, but stay, a mile away from the line.
Right. If you don't even get close to the line, you don't get burned.
That's
right?
Exactly. That's right. But then you may end up with a contract that you can't perform. So that's what we see with our clients. That's the tightrope they're walking.
So what actually is the quiet period? Because I've heard that invoked and I thought it used to be when the RFP dropped. But when actually is it?
When the RFP drops, and the talk about a quiet period, even after the RFP drops, making use of the vendor Q&A is crucial. Even after the RFP drops, there should be some period. You can't engage in conversations that the other guy doesn't know about, but you can still, as long as, that vendor Q&A process takes place, even after the quiet period, you still should have a chance to address issues even once the RFP is out on the street.
Yeah, that's a great point, and that's something, too, that when I was in government, that question and answer period, it was important, but I think there needs to be greater thought to how it's executed, because it often turns into like a question and answer mill, right?
Yes.
And the government is just trying to answer as many questions as possible, as quickly as possible, to keep the procurement on schedule. And to the extent the questions are very focused and they actually raise issues, somehow there's got to be some positive benefit, articulated in the system to the government to take the time to actually look at the questions and not just check the box.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true.
So,
I think for the contractors, again, the challenge is that you're given 4 weeks to respond to an RFP. The questions are due generally after the first week.
Sure.
You may get responses the second week. Well, at that point, you've made all your assumptions because you can't wait for the responses to the questions. You've developed your solution. You've built your team. You have your whole approach solidified. So it becomes very difficult to turn the ship around at that point.
Very
true. Right. And I guess that's the point I was trying to make that Lois just made more. I mean, the government's got to be willing to take the time. Not too much time, right? But the time to have a well thought out procurement process, mm-hmm. and in what you just actually described, it does happen a lot, and it does limit the government's ability to get the type of solution it really needs to perform the work. I mean, that that's a great the point that people have crafted their solutions because time is of the essence. Then they get questions and answers like a week before the proposals do. What that does them no good. Yeah. That doesn't do the government any good, and ultimately it doesn't do the taxpayer any good.
Yep.
And that's what I think gets back to what you were saying before about, you know, engaging earlier and maybe helping, you know, working with the government, between government and industry on specific procurements so that people can truly be aligned in terms of what is required, what information is required for the contractors to be able to compete. Because the government doesn't necessarily have time to gather that information, because that's usually what a lot of it is.
Right.
Would you please provide us this, or would you please? And the response is generally no.
Right. What you convinced me is that Mythbusters needs a reboot in a certain sense, right? So when we come back, we'll be talking more to Lois Gannon. Lois is Senior Vice President, AOC Key Solutions, and Jason Workmaster, partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge. And when we come back, we'll talk to Jason a little bit about data reporting. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Lois Gannon. She is Senior Vice President at AOC Key Solutions, and Jason Workmaster, who's a partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, LLP. And Jason, when we took the break, I teased the audience by saying we're going to talk a little data reporting requirements. And so I'd like to get your take on what's going on. Are we on data overload, I think, would be the question of the day.
I think we are, and the government wants more and more and more of it. I think we see across procurement that RFPs are asking for more. They're not necessarily asking for what we call certified cost or pricing data, but they're asking for other than cost or pricing data, ever more of it. Even though I have doubts that the government itself has the ability to process all the data that they are requesting, but they still want more, because there does seem to be a concern within the government that they're not getting as good a pricing as they could, and the answer that they seem to be coming up with for that perceived problem is to get more data.
Right, and is that, you know, I just when you mentioned that, it made me think about commercial item contracting, right?
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's having an impact on the use of commercial item contracting, in this, because the government says, even though it's commercially available,
yes,
there's market pricing for it,
yes,
they somehow think they're not getting a good deal. So they're saying, give us data,
yes,
when they should just be, you know, competing the requirement, right, and getting, you know, pricing based on full and open competition and adequate price
there really seems to be a thought within the government right now that competition is not good enough, that simply relying on competition is not getting them the pricing that they like. And of course, you know, one of the premises of our entire acquisition system is that, you know, competition is the general rule, and as long as you have it, you can have as much confidence as you're going to get that you're getting a good price. But there seems to be within the government right now that competition is not good enough.
Yeah, full and open competition isn't good enough. Yeah. I like that. I'll remember that. Yeah.
So are they not receiving enough, you know, a large enough quantity of bids, or are they not receiving high enough quality bids so that they actually have a critical mass?
You know, I think that there's a sense within the government that they're not doing what they can to leverage their buying power. And so they themselves aren't sure, you know, for example, you know, if you take an easy one, you know, a pencil, you know, the Department of Interior is spending, you know, 20 cents a pencil. Well, DOD goes out and buys pencils and they're spending $1 a pencil. Well, the government, I think, it has a sense that that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but of course, DOD is doing it right within the realm of the, you know, group that's bidding on their contracts. And then the group that's bidding over here on DOI's contracts, they're doing it right. But there's still this sense, I think, within the government, how can that be? It's the same pencil. And so I think that the government wants to, you know, be mining its own data better than it has been. So, I mean, again, the answer to all of this, at least from the government's perspective right now, just seems to be, we're going to analyze our data more and we're going to get more data from you.
Right. And a lot of the data you're talking about, Jason, is actually data that the government already has.
That is correct.
Right.
That is
but
correct.
But the government asked for it because it can't manage it. So it wants it presented to it in a package by the contractors that it thinks it will be able to analyze,
and
right?
Yeah, I think it relates back to the shrinking acquisition workforce, and it relates back to shrinking budgets for the acquisition workforce. You know, I think that government, part of this is government is pushing off its the cost of analyzing the data, is pushing it off to industry. I mean, because they just don't have the money.
Right.
So they just have this instinct that they're not able to leverage their buying power, but they don't have the facts, and so they're just struggling.
I think that's
right. You hit it right on the head, and one of the things that they're asking, but the problem with the asking for the pricing data is price alone is incomplete data, yeah. Right? You have to understand the terms and conditions of each procurement, volume commitments, those type of things, to understand the pricing. So to the extent they're asking for this pricing data, they're getting incomplete data and not good data to make good business decisions.
And you're going to end up with apples to oranges comparisons. And when the government is trying to pass that responsibility off to the bidders, first of all, it's going to drive up the cost. It's going to drive up the cost, which is eventually going to it's going to drive up the B&P costs of the contractors, which is eventually going to find its way into the pricing the government's paying. So I think it's a bit short-sighted of a solution.
Well, and another thing that you mentioned about apples and oranges again has to do with structuring the procurements in a way that the pricing that's requested, the templates that they provide and the instructions that they provide are clear enough so they, in fact, get like information from all the competitors because they don't right now. They really don't.
Right.
I mean, and that's why they struggle with doing their analysis and the contractors struggle with providing them with what they know they need.
Right. What you're saying is clear proposal preparation instructions. And a lack of clarity, confuses a requirement, leads to bid protests, right, Jason?
It does. And, it can, yes.
Yes. And actually, ultimately, the solution may not be optimal, right?
If it's, right.
The instructions aren't clear and your evaluation, especially in the best value procurement, I would think that'd be a big issue.
Yes.
And one of the things that even when the government thinks it's, reducing the workload, I think they don't realize or aren't clear. Like OASIS is a perfect example. I think the data reporting requirements there are very, very significant in terms of the proposal preparation. I don't know if you had any thoughts of that or not, Jason.
No, I think that's right. I think OASIS is a good example. I think that I do think that the data requirements there are so significant with respect to even past performance. Being tied to particular NAICS codes, and I mean, just figuring that out, mining through your past, if you're a large company, mining through your past performance information, and now trying to tie it to a NAICS code that you didn't even have in mind at the time, is a significant undertaking. Just that, put aside, mining all the pricing data that you're going to have to generate to be
right.
responsive.
Sure. And then in another area, I think that I know you focus on a lot is GSA schedules,
yes.
And there's a lot of pricing information being asked there, right?
There is, and the data requirements for the schedules have always been significant. I mean, to the initial disclosure that you have to make of your past commercial pricing on the items you want to get on schedule, and then tracking your commercial pricing going forward for purposes of the price reductions clause. There's always been a significant compliance burden there. In terms of gathering information that GSA wants to see, and now GSA is saying through their solicitation that we're not sure that even if you tell us the best price you've ever sold something for. So again, back to my example, the pencil. Even though it is absolutely the truth that the lowest price I've ever given for this pencil is $1, GSA is saying, well, you know what, that other company, they're selling it for 50 cents. Give me the 50 cents. And that again was not, the whole premise of the schedules was you get on schedule by getting on at your best pricing. And what we're hearing from GSA is even if it truly is your best pricing, if it's not somebody else's best price, you're not getting on schedule.
Right, and that's inconsistent with the current regulatory structure, right?
It's inconsistent with the current regulatory structure. It's also I think the schedules have been having an identity crisis for years. Going back
on that thought, Jason, hold that thought. We'll come back to that when we come back from the break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Lois Gannon. She is Senior Vice President, AOC Key Solutions, and Jason Workmaster, Partner, McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And we'll finish that schedules conversation, and we'll ask Lois about keys to successfully preparing proposal responses. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Lois Gannon. She is a senior vice president at AOC Key Solutions, and Jason Workmaster, partner at McKenna Long and Aldridge LLP. And Jason, you were on a riff about GSA schedules, and you know, we had to take the break, but you want to get back on that riff?
Sure,
okay,
sure, go ahead. Absolutely. Well, as I was saying, you know, from my perspective, the GSA schedules have been having an identity crisis for a number of years. And going back to the, you know, this, the FAR was amended, 8.4 was amended to require additional competition at the task order level. And so that you have this injection of competition because there was a concern that schedule pricing, even though by statute schedule pricing is fair and reasonable pricing, right?
Right.
That
right.
By statute it's declared.
Right.
And so that the ordering agency should have some confidence in those prices. Our 8.4 was amended to require additional competition because there was a concern that schedule pricing wasn't good enough. So we're going to use the task order competitions to drive pricing down even further. And again, that has created this kind of schizophrenia within the schedules of you've got supposedly the schedule prices are good, but they're not good enough. We've got to have competition. We're going to still keep the price reductions clause. And now we're hearing from GSA that even if that's all working great, it's still not good enough. So I don't know exactly where GSA is going to end up on all those issues, but you know they've created a schedule program now that is kind of at odds with itself, and I don't know exactly where that's all going
to
land.
Right. Well, to your point, I think the regulatory competition requirements are statutorily based.
Yes.
Right. It was I think it was the NDAA of 2009,
I believe,
Section 863, I believe, that mandated. You know, competition for all orders over $150,000, and you know, you make a great point because GSA has invested millions and millions of dollars in electronic systems designed to foster competition and transparency at the task order level.
Mm-hmm.
The regulations put in place and the laws amended to require that competition, and so it's a marketplace. But at the same time, there's the focus on data submission and contract pricing when, there's all this infrastructure designed to lead to competition for specific requirements at the order level, because it's the one thing that GSA does not have, right? GSA does not have a specific requirements
Correct.
For the program.
Correct.
The specific requirements at the order level are what drive pricing.
Yep.
And I think that's been lost to a certain extent. And, you know, with regard to the price reduction clause, I think that fundamentally restricts competition.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that GSA waived the clause for an Air Force procurement, you know, in order to foster full competition on that Air Force procurement, you know, it's basically the GSA's actions speak louder than the words. And the fact that they waived it to enhance competition, you know,
mm-hmm. It keeps people out. I mean, it certainly keeps people
out. Well, it also, like, you know, the question becomes, is it policy, procurement, and economic policy that as a condition of having a GSA schedule contract, you're going to limit a company's ability to compete for other federal work or for other commercial transactions?
Yeah.
I mean, that has an impact on jobs.
It does, absolutely.
So, Lois, one of the things we also, you know, enough of my sort of, you know, sort of preaching to the choir there, right, Jason? We've had many conversations about this. But, you know, Lois, one of the things we also wanted to talk about is, you know, best practices or keys to successfully responding to RFPs during this segment. So I wanted to give you a chance to talk about what you believe some of the key things that companies need to think about.
Okay. One of the first things is, one of the first rules that everyone knows, and very few people, again, because of scarce resources, has a chance to do, is advance planning. And that's really, really a key, so that you're not playing catch up when it comes out. And it's really very basic, and everyone knows it. You know, you should know the customer, so customer intimacy, knowing their needs and wants, and that has to do with, you know, business development and capture, developing an actual structured call plan that then is executed. And it hits every level of the government, and it involves, engages every section of your company, you know, at the executive level and all the functional areas, so that you really, truly understand the customer. So that's one of the things. Other things are knowing the competition. Again, targeted at specific procurements. You know, what will the potential teams be? Who will the primes and subs be for the procurement? And a third thing is, and this is always one of the hardest, every single time when you go into a company, there are so many of us now, so many, quote, Beltway bandits. What are your key discriminators? If you go into every company, they're almost always the same. So you really, really, really have to target what differentiates your team, your company, whether it's your processes, your systems, your people, in a way that's truly convincing and credible. And that's hard.
Right. So you're saying really know thyself, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you
got to
understand.
Yeah. Know thyself in a way that truly distinguishes you from everybody else.
Right. And part of that, too, is part of that understanding yourself. You have to marry that up with understanding the customer, right? I'm doing, mm-hmm. you know, this is sort of one-on-one mm-hmm. stuff, but it's important to talk about because you got to look at that evaluation criteria in Section M and understand what the government's seeing as discriminators.
Right.
And
right.
understand, and that, you have to understand that first or second, or at the same time, you understand what what discriminates you from other people, right?
Right. So again, right, when the actual procurement comes out, then you do have an L, you know, instruction, Section L and an M evaluation criteria. And that you should be looking at, again, informed by your knowledge of the customer and the things that are unspoken in the procurement in terms of the eval criteria. They're, quote, hot buttons. You know, what's important to them, what keeps them awake at night. And so you should not only be responding to those evaluation criteria that are in Section M, but also the things that you know that they really care about. So right. So both.
Yeah. Jason, what role do you play, you know, do the lawyers play in a RFP review process?
Up front. I mean, what we would do is, you know, when we look at an RFP, as lawyers, we're looking for it's similar. I mean, we're helping the clients with this very task of, are there ambiguities here that need to be resolved? Where are the risks? And you know, then I help working with clients to help through vendor, you know, to the extent that we can convince clients to pay us to do this, but help them through the vendor Q&A process. You know, what are the ambiguities you care most about? And then, you know, be thinking, if this is something you submit your vendor Q&A, you get the answer back, and it's still not satisfactory. You know, then we're working with clients. Okay, you do have some options out there as to if you really think this is a big deal, and we need to level the playing field here because this is an ambiguity that could create big problems for you if you get the contract. Then it's talking about, is it worth a protest? And going to GAO or the Court of Federal Claims and trying to get a judicial solution. And that's always a tricky calculus. That's tough for contractors. Even, you know, we have seen a tremendous uptick in bid protest activity in the last few years, ever, you know, really since 2008. There's just been massively, you know, we've seen way more of it in our practice. But even with that, clients are very nervous about, you know, suing the customer. It's not something that the people want to do.
Right, sure.
And so it's got to be a big deal, and it's got to be a lot of risk, and we try and help clients work their way through it. Is it worth it?
Right.
I think people and the government have become desensitized to protests. I mean, I think it's almost expected. And honestly, I've worked for enough contractors that are, you know, putting in their proposals and actually building into their internal timelines the protest interval.
Yep. No.
Because they actually know that after, you know, the award, there probably will be a protest. Yep. So in their internal schedules, they're building
that. That's exactly. Yep. And we see the same thing. We absolutely see the same thing from both the agency perspective and the clients.
Well, you know what? On that happy note, we'll have to take our last break.
All right.
But when we come back, we'll be talking more to Lois Gannon, AOC Key Solutions, Senior Vice President, and Jason Workmaster, McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, Partner. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Lois Gannon. She's Senior Vice President at AOC Key Solutions. And Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And Lois, you know, we're going to start this segment talking a little bit about the drill.
The drill
post RFP release.
The 30-day drill.
Right. So can you talk about, you know, the steps that you go through with your clients when the RFP comes out and you've got a, I mean, obviously, you mentioned earlier, there's all this release work and background work and knowing the customer, but, you know, okay, so now we've got something to execute on. What happens?
Right. So ideally, we've been engaged in the pre-release phase, and in the real world, we're often engaged, you know, a day or two after the RFP drops. Depending on the work that the company has already done, which most of them really have for these really must-win procurements, you have to act quickly, get the RFP out to the pre-identified team because they should already have identified, quote, functional owners for each area of responsibility, whether it's finance, contracts, past performance, the technical solution team, all of those people are pre-identified. And you get the RFP out to them so they can start looking at it because the clock is ticking toward the questions due date. And so what you also do at the same time as a proposal manager is shred the RFP, which is the very tedious but necessary process of going through every single clause and every single page of the RFP, starting with the instructions and focusing mostly on the evaluation criteria and also integrating the statement of work and addressing every single clause, finding a place for it. So someone in the outline is going to have to review that clause and, if not respond to it, at least acknowledge it and make sure that they've, in fact, read it and understand it and are willing to accept it. So that's one of the actions. So shredding the RFP is just followed by convening the team, starting with a kickoff, and that involves getting alignment, which you keep throughout the proposal response process. In the ideal world, again, you have everyone in a war room. That doesn't exist so much anymore. A lot of, quote, virtual war rooms.
Sure.
People all over the country doing stuff. You create a schedule. Stick to the schedule. Identify really good reviewers, not people that say, you know, that are really critical and say things like needs more meat, beef it up. You need people who look at it critically and from a knowledgeable perspective and provide really constructive and actionable feedback. And what we like to do is create a collaborative environment in the way we run reviews. So it's a little bit different than the way some companies run reviews, but we found it to be very effective.
Right. So you're saying it's got to be specifics. It's not these generalities kind of things. It's specific, you know, comments that are addressable and can make a difference, right? That's
right.
What you provide. Yeah.
Right. And what we try to do is we try to actually have a collaborative thing. So it's not that we have the team hold up, the reviewers hold up in a room, and, you know, the writers then get the big reveal at the end of the day, at least at the beginning of the process, in the pink team process, which is the first review. We actually have that as an exchange. You know, where people are providing guidance in real time. So it's much more helpful, much less bloody.
Yeah. So, and how, one question I did have is how, you know, so you got the technical team and they're putting together a solution and the pricing team, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do they get together so that the price reflects, you know, the solution?
Well, generally what they have in internal...
Or vice versa.
Well, internal to the company, because they're generally not bidding solo because of all these small business requirements now, small business subcontracting requirements, they're getting pricing from their partners. And I would say the glue that holds things together is probably the capture person. So they're working across the technical solution team and also the partners and pricing to make sure that they have all the elements they need from the partners and internally from the technical team and that they're all consistent. So they're putting together apples to apples pricing, even internally, because often, you know, they're getting different information. No matter what template you send out, we all know that it comes back with different information in it. So it's kind of an iterative process.
Right. And you mentioned subcontractors and small businesses and stuff. And one of the things I did want to go back to, it's a great segue, but one of the things I want to go back to is talk about these NAICS code requirements these days that... And what do they mean for small businesses in the current environment and in the way RFPs are currently structured?
Well, it's putting a lot more burden on small businesses to get, you know, qualified within certain NAICS codes. Because again, from the government's perspective, they want to be able to say, okay, this RFP is for NAICS code X. You've got NAICS code X. Therefore, you can bid. Well, you, this other guy, you got NAICS code Y. Well, you, well, that's, this isn't NAICS code X. You're out of it. Well, and guy with NAICS code Y says, well, but I can do that. Well, that's too bad. You don't have the right NAICS code. So that isn't putting putting an increasing burden on small businesses to make sure they're slotted into the right slot, in addition to having their, you know, having the good housekeeping seal of approval that they actually are the kind of small business they say they are.
Right. Does that also have an increasing impact on government? I mean, you know, because governments, the logic would tell me, you know, the contracting officer is now under increasing pressure to make sure he picks, quote, the right NAICS code.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's probably the NAICS code process starts with the best of intentions, which is we're going to make this easy for everybody. We're going to attach numbers to the kind of work you do rather than having to sort through all the varied, long paragraphs of description of what you do. So I think that starts with the best of intentions, but the problem is it becomes something else that, you know, again, from my perspective, it's just yet another thing that can be audited. And it's another thing that can be audited and second-guessed and questioned down the road, both internally within the government and for the contractor. And, you know, again, from my perspective, I represent contractors. The consequences to contractors can be quite draconian if they don't get that right.
Right, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it adds another level of complexity, because if it's a small business set aside procurement and they assign a NAICS code to it, then it puts the burden directly on the small business. Mm-hmm. And if it's full and open and a large business bids on it and it has that NAICS code assigned to it, they still have to assign NAICS codes to the small businesses. And again, instead of just being self-certified small businesses that they're including in their team, they have to look at the NAICS codes that the small businesses are certified for, and then they have to match those to the work that they're being assigned to perform.
As a subcontractor,
so
right?
It becomes, yeah, you know, difficult.
Right, absolutely. So, where does this all go with that, with the NAICS code? Are we making things more complicated than they need to be, Jason?
My view, yes, we are. I mean, it's the common answer to every problem is to throw more process at it. And from my perspective, this is not in my self-interest to say, but the folks that really benefit from throwing more process at stuff are the lawyers.
Right.
Not government procurement generally. It's the lawyers, because I teach our summer associates class on government contracts research every once in a while. I still have the DOD FAR supplement from when I first started in private practice 12 years ago, and I have the one from this year. The DOD Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement is three times as large as it was 12 years ago. And I always ask the question, do we really think DOD procurement is three times as good because we have three times as many regs? I have the same kind of feeling about what we're doing with NAICS codes.
Wow, you really are. I mean, that is against your self-interest.
So. No, but it's really interesting and true.
Right. So, you know, Lois, on that note, we do have to end the show, so I want to thank my guests, Lois Gannon, Senior Vice President, AOC Key Solutions, and Jason Workmaster, Partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.